Today is November 5th, 1974, a Tuesday. The following interview is with Raymond K. Price. The interview will take place in Mr. Price's office, room 170 of the old executive office building. Terry Good will conduct the interview.
It began on Washington's birthday, 1967, when I was in the middle of writing a novel at home. The Herald Tribune had collapsed back in the fall of 66 when I was trying to do this novel. And it began when I got a call from our mutual friend Walter Thayer, who had been president of the Trib and was a longtime associate of his, the morning of Washington's birthday, to say that Mr. Nixon had asked him, Walter, whether he had any idea whether I might be interested in going to work for him. And so Walter called and asked, what should he tell him? And I told Walter that this was out of the blue. Incidentally, I had one of the worst hangovers in my life that morning, from what I'd forgotten. That I hadn't yet thought ahead to 1968 to who my candidate would be for the nomination, much less for the election. Because though a lifelong Republican, I had supported Johnston in 64 and had written the Herald Tribune's editorial endorsing him for Republican Cribs. Beyond that, I had no idea whether I'd want to get involved in a campaign or not, because I had a pretty good sense of what getting involved in a campaign means and all that. Weighing all these things, I suppose the chances were less than 50-50 that I'd be interested. I had not known Mr. Nixon. If understanding this, he wanted to talk, I'd be honored and delighted to have a chance to chat with him. And then about 10 minutes later, the phone rang again, and the voice said, hello, this is Dick Nixon. Could I come to lunch with you that day? So I tried to put my hangover away and went over and met him at his apartment on Fifth Avenue, and we spent about 3 hours in a fascinating discussion ranging over over lunch, served by Manolo, on trays in the den. A fascinating three-hour discussion ranging over just about everything, the nation and the world, and politics, and public affairs, and life in general, and people in particular. And and he ran through the various strengths and weaknesses as he saw them of the various candidates and so forth. I was vastly more impressed than I'd expected to be, as I think most people have been when they've seen him only at a distance before and suddenly encounter him in person. And he asked, at the end of it, as I was leaving, he asked me to get back in touch with him within a week and let him know whether I would like to do it, because he was going to be leaving on a series of trips very shortly thereafter, and he wanted to get it settled one way or the other. And so I spent that next week intensively researching it, trying to think it through in terms of the various qualifications of various candidates as I saw them, and thinking through whether I would want to commit myself to this kind of involvement, which I knew would have to be a pretty total sort of thing. And finally, 1 week later, decided that yes, he was my candidate, and yes, I would like to be part of it. And so called him back that afternoon on March 1st. He was at his office then, and said if he were still interested, I would like to do it. So he asked me to come down to the office. I did. I started work that night, and I've been doing it ever since.
Were you brought on board to be his speechwriter? Was that the initial assignment you had?
Well, not really. It was understood that that there would be some of this involved. At that stage, it was before we had a campaign committee or anything else, and I was given an office in his law firm. It was basically to begin whatever had to be done in helping to organize a possible campaign to help set up a research operation was obviously a particular part of it. And it really got to be a little bit of everything, as there were so few of us then involved.
Who were the other major people at that point in time, right?
On the staff, as actual full-time staff who were there, Pat Buchanan, who had started the previous year, Rose Woods. Len Garment was a law partner, but who was spending about maybe half his time just informally in and out of the campaign operation. Tom Evans, not the one who became deputy chairman of the RNC, but the other Tom Evans, was a law partner who was spending maybe half of his time as sort of a general manager for the campaign. And Ann Higgins, now, and she was Ann Holtz then, was at the law firm handling correspondence and so forth. John Sears was also a young law partner who was spending part of his time on the campaign. Let's see. A lot of others were in and out. For example, Maury Stans was raising money from the outside. Peter Flanagan was involved a little bit from the outside. Shortly after I started, Bob Ellsworth came aboard on a sort of a half-time basis. He had a law practice in Washington, and but he got an arrangement whereby he would spend about half his time while still based in Washington working with us. Bryce Harlow would be in and out a little bit, as I recall, I think, on a permanent basis. And then a few months later, we got the start of a campaign organization and so forth.
I won't pursue this campaign period any longer. That's extremely important, but I know your time's limited, and I guess we'll push on. That gives me the background that I was interested in. After the election, during the transition period, at what point were you asked to join Mr. Nixon, his presidential staff, or was it understood back when you had your initial contact with him that if elected, you would stay on with him?
It was never explicitly understood. In fact, I hadn't planned on it. I think there was a general feeling that those of us who were there and wanted to probably would, but there had never been anything explicit. And in fact, it wasn't until about 3 weeks before the election that I finally decided, if asked, I would do it. And I was actually formally asked, I would guess maybe 10 days after the election, a week or 10 days after the election. I'd been vacationing down on the Gulf Coast of Florida and got a call from Key Biscayne to come on over, and they wanted to announce my appointment to the staff then.
And that offer was with the understanding that you would continue as a speechwriter again, or?
Yep, it was. And Buchanan and I were announced at the same time. I think we were something like the fourth and fifth ones announced.
After you moved then to Washington, D.C. and set up shop, as I recall, Jim Keogh was the top man in the speechwriting operation. You and Pat Buchanan. I think there were several other primary people involved at that time. Could you just kind of run through that organizational structure?
Yes. And it was something, the core of it was really set up during the campaign after the Republican convention, when we had all gone out to Mission Bay, California, after the convention, in order to try to organize the post-nomination campaign. And it was at that time that Jim Keogh was brought in to head up as sort of managing editor for the writing operation. And when we came to the White House, we came in essentially with that kind of an operation, with Jim running it, myself, Pat Buchanan, Bill Sapphire. I guess Jim and the three of us were the only commissioned ones at that point. There were others on the staff. Lee Huebner had been in the campaign and came in as part of the writing staff. Also Bill Gavin, Tom Houston. He had worked in Washington during the campaign, but he came at the start as part of the writing operation. I'm feeling I'm forgetting one or two names there.
Well, I think the four primaries were the ones I was most concerned with. Was there any manner in which it was organized so that some assignments went to you, some went to Bill Sapphire, and others went to Pat Buchanan? Was there any division of responsibility within the speech writing operation?
Not in any formal sense. And I might digress a moment to say, in addition to the basic writing thing we brought in from outside, we kept the research operation that had been established under the Johnson administration, under Seal Dellinger, and that grew. And my understanding is that had never existed in the White House until Will Sparks, under Johnson, when he took over, was appalled to find there wasn't any. And as he explained it to me once, felt that somewhere in the government there has got to be a former Time researcher, Time magazine researcher, because they have a superb research capacity there. And he found two, including Seal, who was then with USIA, and he brought her in. And that was the start of the research operation in the White House. And also Eliska Hasek, who had messages to groups and individuals for us, had done this under Johnson, and we kept her in the same capacity. And of course, the correspondence section kept that running. But in terms of division among the writers themselves, not in any formal sense, but of the three of us, Bill and Pat and myself, each of us had a very different style and approach, and we tended very often to have different interests. Our assignments would pretty much tend to go along those lines. If it were a hardline law and order thing, for example, it would be Buchanan. Sort of a more philosophical type thing, it might be me. Bill was a good sort of all-purpose kind of a guy. Bill also did a lot of contributing lines and phrases. He's a great phrase maker. As it developed, Bill Sapphire developed sort of a specialty in economics. And for a long time, most economic speeches or messages were done by Bill. Foreign policy, we all did at various times. Again, Pat would be more likely to be turned to when it was a real hardline type thing. Bill or myself or something else.
Would you, on occasion, consult with one another on a particular speech that one of you might have had primary responsibility for?
Yes, we would. Mm-hmm. And of course, in writing, a large part of the writing chore is consultation with people with substantive responsibilities, whether on the White House staff or in departments and agencies or whatever, or NSC. And we also would kick things around ourselves. And at that stage, we had also regular meetings of the writing staff. I think most of the time it was a scale of about 2 or 3 a week, in which we would kick around among ourselves upcoming speaking engagements, for example, and sort of brainstorm what things might be appropriate for that and so forth. And we often would argue around what kind of approaches might be taken also.
Now, those sessions would have just involved the three of you, or would have also included Jim Keough?
It would have included Jim Keough and the three of us and the other writers. These would be meetings of the writing staff, presided over by Jim.
And those would have taken place roughly 2 or 3 a week, depending upon Mr. Nixon's activities, I suppose.
No, we had a regular schedule of them, and I've forgotten now just what the schedule was, but my recollection was it was about 2 or 3 a week. I think my recollection also is that we experimented with different schedulings of them. We may even have tried it once a day for a while. I don't think we did, but we might have, and found that was too much. You can very easily get meeting to death in this place.
Jim Keough left, I guess, a year or two after, sometime 77?
He left December 31, 1970. So basically, he was here for the first 2 years.
And then?
Then I took over.
Okay, then there's the shift, the change. You take over. Buchanan and Sapphire are still here.
Right.
Mm-hmm. there any organizational or administrative change that you enacted once you took over the shop, or did it continue to operate pretty much as it had?
It continued pretty much as it had, except that shortly after I took over, just kind of informally, Buchanan and Sapphire moved out of the kind of formal organizational structure of it. We still worked together and so forth, but they kind of set up more or less independently, working through me on most things, Sapphire more than Buchanan, that so they would be working for the kind of things that my department was responsible for.
But in terms of the assignments that they received, economics still went to Sapphire, philosophical were primarily handled by you. I don't mean to make that hard line or concrete, but generally speaking, would that same arrangement apply?
Generally speaking, yeah. Now, when Jim Keough had been a non-writing editor, basically, there. He did very, very little of this. When I took over, it was with the understanding that I should do both. I should continue to do a fair amount of the writing, though less than before, while also being the sort of the editor-in-chief. And so, in that sense, it was a change. Buchanan got to getting most of his assignments directly, not through me, from the president or from Haldeman. And with a couple of exceptions, they were not speech-type assignments. Sapphire continued to do quite a lot of speech writing.
Did the staff under you grow numerically? Huebner was still here, Gavin was still here. Houston, I think, had left by then. No, I don't think so. He didn't leave until early 71, did he?
I forget when he left the staff. He left the writing department, really, before he left the staff. And he went off into this security thing, which we've lately learned more about.
Right. I'm trying to think of the other staff members that have been on here, at least. John Andrews, I don't know.
Let's see, John Andrews had been working for Ziegler, and I hired him as for the writing staff. He'd been sort of an administrative aide to Ziegler.
I'm sorry, I don't have a list of all the people.
Now, see, I guess my first hire was Dave Gergen, probably, whom I brought in to be assistant to me as sort of a junior assistant, too, when I was also looking for a deputy at that time, more senior deputy. Dave, I never did fill that senior deputy slot, and Dave eventually developed into that, and then was my successor when I moved out at the end of the first term, moved out of that spot. And also shortly after taking over, I hired Noel Cook as a writer. Let's see, I hired McLaughlin. That was a little later on. There was quite a squabble over whether he should be hired or not. And let's see, who else? Gavin left Memory Plays Tricks. I think he left shortly after I took over. He might have left shortly before I took over. I don't recall. We had been expanding the research staff, and we continued to expand that a little bit while I was running. We also expanded somewhat the letters staff. I hired Roland Elliott to head that, and then we also, the president was very much interested in the correspondence operation, and he kept pressing and for more and better attention to that, and as part of that we did expand the staff. Let's see, I hired Bakshian, I think that was probably in 72. I hired Jack McDonald, I think around December of 71. And Ken Kachigian had been on the staff here in various capacities. He ended up pretty much working for Buchanan about the time that I shifted out of the writing department. We brought him into the writing department also.
I'm sure you probably touched upon the most significant of the writers, those people on the staff for that period.
Oh, and Tex Lazar also. I hired him in 71. he'd also be assisting me on some of my projects. And then when I left the writing department and came over here, he came along as my assistant here.
What was the date of that change for you?
It was early 73. It was essentially the start of the second term. And I'm not sure whether it would be possible to pin down an exact date or not, because I was sort of just shifting out of here and turning it over to Dave.
For that period of time that you were in charge of the speechwriting shop, did you stay more or less in your office, or were you traveling every time the president traveled?
I traveled sometimes with him. I basically stayed here. I would guess that maybe half the time when he went to San Clemente, I went. Maybe half. Almost never to keep his game. I made some of the foreign trips with him. I made the 72 Moscow summit, the Mexican trip to Puerto Vallarta. Let's see. I also made the, before I took it over, I made the Asian-Romanian trip in, well, I guess, 69 or 70. And I had also made a similar Asian trip with him before he was president back in 1967. Out of which grew, incidentally, my first writing collaboration with him, which was a piece for Foreign Affairs called Asia After Vietnam, which has often been looked back on as sort of the genesis of the Nixon Doctrine. And I went to Paris with him for de Gaulle's funeral. That was just before I took over. As a matter of fact, it was on that trip that I was asked to take over the writing shop. That's probably why I was asked to come along. I made some other domestic trips, I don't think very many. In the 72 campaign, I went to, of course, I was down with him at the convention, and then the swing we made out to California after that. But I did not regularly go on the campaign trips. And I don't think I went on any of the campaign trips in 70, I'm not sure.
When you were traveling with him, it was for the purpose of finalizing speeches and writing speeches?
Well, it was sometimes so. On the major trips, it would be. We also developed a system there, which I didn't get too much involved in traveling. I'm sure I must have a few times. But after not having done it initially, and I think this was under Jim, that we got this set up, if I remember rightly. Maybe it was under me, but I think under Jim. That ordinarily, the writer who had prepared the material for the president for a particular appearance would go along so that he could see how it worked and how it played and how the president used it and so forth. And this was partly to be available in case there were anything needed at the time, but also partly for the writer's education and to develop into a little better product.
So in some instances, you went along because you had prepared the speech. In other cases, you went along because you were in charge of the shop and had other things to contribute.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Or, say, when we're going to San Clemente, just to be out there because that's where the center of operations was.
The documentation of your contributions, whether it was in the form of editor-in-chief, manager of the shop, or whether in the form of various revisions and drafts of a speech. Are those somewhere, Ray?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So at some point in the future, we would be able to trace your input, your drafts, we'd be able to set them up and say, okay, here's the first, second, third for this particular speech, with the president's comments and your revisions.
Well, that's in the files. Of course, a lot of it was just done verbally.
And then that needs to be pointed out so that it will perhaps be a disappointment if there are some things that aren't there, it's to be understood that that was because it was a verbal discussion between you and the president or whoever.
It might be between me and the president, or it might be between me and Haldeman. A lot of our guidance came by way of Haldeman. or it might be between me and the writer, if I were acting as editor and the writer, we would be kicking things around at great length, talking it out, how to approach the thing.
In those cases where you simply reviewed or perhaps revised a draft that had been prepared by another writer, will your initial appear somewhere on that draft to show that you have at least looked at it?
Ordinarily, yes, because the at least when it was ready to go to the president, it would have in the upper left-hand corner the writer's name and the editor's initials. It might be Price J.K., meaning it was something that had been written by Price and signed and approved by Jim Keough. It might have Andrews R.P., meaning it had been written by Andrews and approved by me, or D.G. for Gergen or something like that.
And would the number of that draft be on there?
Yes, it would. Mm-hmm. And the date.
Well, it sounds like then that the documentation of those speeches is fairly complete.
I think it should be, yes.
How about your other activities as more or less manager of the shop? Will there be documents to show whatever you did as manager of the speech writing office? I can't even cite any examples. I don't know what I would find.
Well,
the hiring of staff, perhaps?
Yeah, that would all be documented, the actual hiring. The consideration of ones that we didn't hire, that would partly be there and partly not. Of course, a lot of it, of course, so much of what happened in the White House was really just informal conversation over the luncheon table or by the water cooler, in effect, even though it wasn't water cooling. That would not be there. A fair amount would be there in the form of memos and so forth, which would be memos and recommendations of what might be talked about and so forth.
Did you maintain a cron file of all of the memos you might have written?
We maintained a cron file, but the cron file by itself is not complete because so much of the of what it was speech drafts and so forth, and those would be under subject. Those we've got separately under subject files. You've got them, but they're not all in the cron file because it would be too bulky.
That's what I suspected, but I had to ask the question. Forgive me.
As a matter of fact, you'll find a note to the files in my cron file there explaining that.
Oh, no.
So I think the essentially it's only with regard to the speeches that they're not in there, and those are separately by speech.
Moving on then from when you left the speech writing operation and took on the new responsibility, how would you describe the new assignment that you got?
Well, it started out to be one thing and it ended up being another.
All right.
It started out as something that I had to be something that I had wanted to do for a long time. It had it in the back of my mind ever since Pat Moynihan left. What I call the house philosopher role. I'd wanted to stay maybe roughly a year into the second term and leave. And I had hoped to use that year to get away from the day-to-day stuff and sort of put my feet up and do a lot of thinking. Ideally, I'd hoped to spend about a third of my time traveling and trying to bring in ideas from outside, and roughly the other two-thirds trying to pull together the president's basic philosophies into a fairly coherent whole. So that they could better be understood, not only outside, but also in the government, where I thought they were very little understood, especially the interrelationships and how they fit together. And I hadn't firmed up any specific ways I was going to do this, except I thought it would probably be a mixture of internal memos and perhaps some external writing and that sort of thing. It was to do this that I moved over here. But then 1973 and 74 turned out a little differently than most of us had anticipated. So I ended up doing a lot more speech writing than I'd expected, and just sort of generally troubleshooting. I ended up doing, I guess, most of his major speeches, at least those that were especially personal to him during this period. Part of the arrangement when I moved over here had been that I would continue to be available to him for any special assignments that he particularly wanted me to do. It just turned out to more of those and not much chance to do the philosopher role and a lot of distractions that kept us even from thinking that much about it.
So for this period of time, we will still find drafts of speeches, mm-hmm. Perhaps memos, period of time where we...
Tex Lazar was here as my assistant.
Your contacts within the White House during this period of time could have been with anybody, right?
No.
They probably were.
They were.
Speech writers, domestic counsel.
Mm-hmm. Right. Of course, I did the State of the Union each time, and that gets you, you work with just about everybody on that. And the inaugurals, that sort of thing. Also, I ended up doing his Watergate speeches. April 30th, 1973, when Haldeman wrote the left, and then the May 22nd, 73 white paper, I was the coordinating writer on that, and the August 15th, 1973 speech I did, and then the, let's see, some of his, I was the writer on some of the other things, like letters to Rodino, and like a long letter to Rodino on constitutional points. And of course, there's, and then the April 29th or 30th this year, and then the resignation.
Did you have any set procedure whenever you were given an assignment to prepare a speech on any topic? First of all, contact anyone who might have information, substantive information on it, get that in, review it, absorb it, and then couch it in a language and a style that you thought Mr. Nixon would like?
Well, there's no, I never found any real pattern to all this. And the way it would be done each time would depend very heavily on the circumstances. And it wouldn't always start out the same way. Like sometimes, for example, he'd approach an occasion, a speaking occasion, and he would be asking for recommendations from us, from writers, on what he ought to talk about. Then we would try to come up with ideas for what the theme and subject ought to be, and send them in to him or to Haldeman, or both, and get back, yes, no, develop this, whatever, and then go on from there. Of course, there would be a lot of informal discussion with substance-type people along the way. And other times, he would approach it with something specific in his mind that he wanted to say. And we would get this as our initial guidance, which might come directly or might come by way of Haldeman. Then we would proceed to develop this, again, in coordination with the substance people, whoever they might be. And often, of course, his initial ideas would get modified or shot down in the process of this. There might be considerations he just hadn't been aware of or hadn't thought of or something like this, and so you'd go do it differently. And these would ordinarily, speech drafts would ordinarily, of course, be circulated among a good many of the substance people involved, draft by draft. They would have a chance to, sometimes they did and sometimes they didn't, but they would have a chance to comment. Sometimes they didn't, sometimes this wasn't done, sometimes it would be something that he particularly wanted to keep very close to his chest, and that would be only minimal circulation or something like that.
Would there be a document, a cover memo or something to show who received a copy of the draft?
Yes. Yeah, there would be. Mm-hmm. And so then, of course, the writer, a lot of what he does is try to reconcile the irreconcilable conflicting suggestions from the various other people. And this would often be done sitting down, say with a John Whitaker, for example, who would have substantive responsibility for coordinating the agency viewpoints on, say, an environmental matter. And with John, we would normally, the writer and he would very often sort of sit down with some of these people and just sort of talk it out and thrash it out there. And this was one way it was done, other times it was done other ways. But
in instances like that, did you see yourself as more or less an honest broker? Or did you always view your position as you had something to contribute? It wasn't simply a matter of listening to all these sides and trying to put it all together.
Well, it was partly an honest broker. Partly, sometimes it would be something that I would feel I had something to contribute. I was partly also being the president's surrogate there. especially if he had told him what he felt strongly about. And I would be trying to work out ways to accommodate his interests and their interests and their technical understanding with his basic policy direction and that sort of thing. But of course, again, this is something that ordinarily I would try to work very closely with whoever might be the person with prime substantive responsibility on doing and on trying to broker these things out, figuring that he was the expert on this, on the substance policy.
I've never ceased to be amazed at the problems that must confront the writer whenever he's faced with preparing a speech on a matter that involves a lot of technical and sophisticated information, the environmental question. You almost have to undertake a crash educational program, do you not, to inform yourself on the topic?
Yes, you do. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think editorial writing, which I came to this from with a pretty good background, because you tend to, part of that is becoming learning how to be a 24-hour expert. Of course, having been on this side, I see how often they are not expert.
Oh,
but again, the substantive people were very helpful on this. Like and you know, some of the best were, for example, Whitaker, Paul O'Neill, that's right. We would rely very heavily on. And,
Paul O'Neill from the OMB.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Who was always one of the best to work with in movies.
Did you find yourself having contact with people on Capitol Hill to speak of?
Very seldom.
Very seldom. How about special interest groups?
I didn't myself, except to an extremely limited degree.
I would have been surprised if you said so, but that's one of the things we'd just like to tie down and make sure. Your secretary for the entire time you were here, Ray, was Margaret Fredrick.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Your title while you've been on the White House staff, you were initially a special assistant?
That's correct. I was through the first term until I moved into this new slot when I became special consultant for the second term.
Is there any sort of a permanent mailing address that we could always reach you through, let's say 5 years from now or 10 years from now?
I don't know. I'll be staying here for a while, my present address.
Are you a member of any professional organizations that you will continue to be a member of?
Well, the Overseas Press Club in New York, I guess you could call it a professional organization. And I'll probably continue to be a member of that. I guess the only other organizations that I think of that I belong to are that and the Yale Club in New York and the Metropolitan Club and Federal City Club too.
I was going to ask about alumni. They always seem to keep track of their more distinguished ones. So we'll check with Yale. We can't get you through the Overseas Press Club. We have several.
But also, I'll probably be in touch with the Nixon Library over the years.
Well, we look forward to that, that's for sure. One of the other questions that we ask, I don't know if you'll be able to answer, was there any one particular assignment or speech or event that you were involved in that gave you the greatest degree of satisfaction or sense of accomplishment?
That's very hard to say. Each one had its own. Of course, there was a special excitement about the first inaugural that would be hard to match because of the circumstances more than anything else. And also, because in looking back, I think that holds up remarkably well. And I hope that someday people will look back on that and then look at it in terms of promises kept, which I think ranks very high among inaugurals in that regard. I suppose that would probably be the one.
Some people do better than most people when we ask that question. They just simply shake their head and say, no way can I answer that question. Just everything or not any one specific thing. So, Well, as you can see, we have just touched the first layer, even that, but it gives us something to work with. You've provided us with some guidelines, some questions that undoubtedly will come up at some point in the future, and now that we have them, we can move on to the more substantive things, hopefully at a later date with you, and after we've had a chance maybe to go through some of the files and read through some of the drafts of the speeches at some point, and then come back to you and say, why was this change made? Why was this deleted? Why was this added? Well, I've enjoyed this immensely, man. I thank you for being so kind to give up some time on the, what, 2 days before you leave?
Well, 3 days before, I guess. Mm-hmm.
So,
no, I'm very glad to help with it, and I think it's a good project.
Well, we keep our fingers crossed, and we're just kind of moving along gradually, and in many cases, not knowing which direction to turn or where to go, and many times the questions are shot in the dark, so to speak. But we keep accumulating a little bit of information here and there, and over a period of time, we hope that it'll begin to build up into something worthwhile and significant.
Yeah, I do hope that, you know, just in general, that in the future, if there are things I can help with, that you'll feel free to get in touch with me, because I wanted it to be a good library, too. And
well, you're one of those people on the list of the significant ones that we have been told we can count on for advice and guidance. So you may hear from us more often than you care to. I don't know.
No, it. Well, I'll kick this
thing. Let's all just wonder what you're elected in.
We don't.
Jack Messer told me what it is. He's going to bounce off.
We don't know what's going to happen. We'd like to think that the project might just go into kind of a temporary hibernation, I guess, until the trials and court problems are resolved, until perhaps the question of ownership of the papers is resolved. It hinges on so many things that are really out of our control. You probably know better than we do. The members of the Nixon Foundation will kind of well, I'm sure. Congress, my land, what will Congress decide about these papers? Will they go ahead and say, okay, you know, they could go either way. They could say they're the personal property of the president, or they could say they're the property of the government. If they take that option, then the question will have to be resolved, all right, if they're government property, where can they be kept? In California, must extend in Washington area. Well, to resolve that question, then it's a matter of a building to house them, and just so many problems. But our staff is, we got morale problems, but we're no different than anybody else in a lot of us. We've been expecting this to happen. I don't know how much Jack told you, but it looks like he is going after the Truman Library. He will be out there. And
just for my interest in still feeling which is caring about the external issues from my own interest. So I want to get into that, and I've been counting on having you and Jack.
I don't know what's going to happen. But I know that if a library ever comes about, Jack has let everybody that's involved to know that he probably would come back soon. There are a lot of changes made. I think the four or five of us on the staff that have been involved all feel the same way. We may split for the time being until the trials are over with and the paper questions resolved. It looks like for the duration of the trials, the papers are just going to be going to gain access. It's going to require the presence and the approval of all the parties involved. And that could get to be a real hang. And how long that would last, I guess, is anybody's guess. Some of the lawyers say 6 months, others say a year. You know, if these cases are appealed, it could just drag it for 7 years.
Well, it seems that it shouldn't be beyond the reach of human intelligence to devise some way to
in fact, that is something that's being considered and discussed by any number of people, and has been discussed for probably a month now. And they may be moving towards some sort of a compromise. They're trying to screen right now, or they're preparing a project whereby we can go through an inventory of the records there in the custody of the fourth floor primary. Do an inventory of those, and then get the interested parties to agree that this material is not relevant to the trial. That material may be, so they'll hold it back temporarily. But over a period of time, I think they'll end up producing more and more of the material to our custody again, so that we can begin to do whatever is necessary to get it organized and get it into whatever.
Well, I hope they're not the only people who think about it.
Well, I do too. I do too. I know Jack takes this thing very hard. He came here thinking that, you know, this was going to be his career too. And I think the others of us have joined the staff on that one too. I don't look forward to going back to the National Archives and being assigned to whatever, either administrative operation or one of the divisions there that has custody of government records. You know, we've gotten to know not only the, well, we've gotten to know the people more than the records. Yes. And we'd like to think that we've established some sort of rapport with these people that will carry on through the years. And I think that was perhaps one of the basic reasons that we came over, among other things. At least that's how we viewed the operation. And now to see the thing kind of falling apart in front of our eyes is a very unpleasant time. Yeah, I would hate to see other people who have not been here move in and take over. Because those records don't have that kind of meaning for them. I mean, we can see a memo that was written by one person to another person, and we can picture them in our mind's eye, and it takes on a life that it wouldn't have otherwise.
And you can imagine some of the surrounding circumstances.
That's right. Yeah. You know, if there are questions that might arise because of the memo, we can say, well, now I know that person worked in this office, and so let's check these files over here so we can find additional information on that. Gee, I knew that person pretty well. I'd get on the phone and put him right down the bay. He'd probably say, hey, check this file. I know there wasn't anything else on that, or I can explain what the background of that thing. We'd like to think of it as a two-way street, as I said. You do, we can help you, and you can help us. And the American public will benefit. You know, that has been a thing that's irritated me. There's been very little comment about applying that rule to congressional personal papers. I think there were one or two congressmen that have put a bill in the hopper that it has received. I have to think it's a gym. And obviously, it won't. You can look down the road, especially. But I think they're going to cook them somewhere. If they do this connection, there will be, I think, a growing awareness in part of the public that it's kind of an unfair tactic, and that's good for that person, so for them. So I think they'll end up hurting themselves. Well, I've taken up more of your time than I intended. I've enjoyed this, too. But you say you will be back here in Washington.
Yeah, well, for the next year, I'm going to
I knew yeah. that...
And,